Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 430th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor, and I'm the Director of Program of Practice Support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada, and I'm a professor at the University of Alberta.
And as people know, this podcast has always been about the heart.
It comes from the heart.
It does come from the heart. But as with our real hearts in our podcast, we sometimes fail.
They do fail. They struggle.
Yeah.
Their output gets less.
Yeah.
Much like podcasts, at least quality-wise.
And then the Starling curve comes in and everything goes to hell.
Right. And this talk is about the Starling curve. We're going to give three podcasts on the Starling curve and maybe 10 minutes on the evidence for heart. Is that how we're going to do it?
Exactly not. So if you guys haven't figured it out, what we are going to do is we're going to do a synopsis of sort of the best available evidence around heart failure and talk about the studies, talk about the numbers, and try and put it all into context for you guys. So that's sort of the plan.
And now, are we gonna work the Starling curve into each draw? I hope you have data on the Starling curve effects for.
Oh each yeah, of these. Yeah, and we're gonna describe it so well we won't need images. It'll be in the mind's eye. So we'll go from there.
Awesome! Yeah. I'm excited about. I'm sure everyone listening is excited.
Yeah. So what we want to talk about is the evidence around all of the different classes of medications, because you know as well as I do, Mike, when people get heart failure, they get put on a lot of medications. And often, you know, primary care clinicians, pharmacists, no one ever really knows why.
Well, they get thrown on them very quickly, actually. If it's a new onset heart failure, first admission, you're coming home on minimum three drugs.
Yeah.
Not always, but most of the time. And there's reasons behind that. And I think we should caveat this right away, James, by saying we're talking, the majority of what we're going to talk about is systolic heart failure. So a reduced ejection fraction, which is somewhat variably defined, but, you know, less than 40%, less than 30% in some trials, but.
Yeah. And the reason we have to do that is because if you're on medications for diastolic heart failure, you're probably on the wrong ones.
Well, you know, that you're absolutely right. We'll get into it at the end. I think maybe about diastolic heart failure. But desperation and a prescription pad should never run hand in hand. And they do, unfortunately, with diastolic heart failure. It's a terrible condition, just like the systolic heart failure. But let's go on. What are some of the limits?
So some of the caveats are, you know, many of the trials are 20 to 30 years old, which doesn't mean they're bad trials. Some of them are very, very well designed.
I will remind the audience that you and I are far in excess of 20 and 30 years old. Actually, we are bad. So there you go.
Yeah. And the criteria used to define heart failure has changed over time. And so it's not consistent. And when we're talking about all of the different trials, almost all of them are placebo-controlled trials. But that, in other than the very early ones, that means they're actually additive trials. So patients were already on a beta blocker and then an ACE inhibitor was added, or people were on a beta blocker and an ACE inhibitor and then spironolactone was added. And so that's the nuance that we have to work with, because every decision we make, there really are no trials going is one, two, or three better, but they're just constantly additive trials. So it makes it tricky to even look at the evidence.
Right. But when you do look at it, like, for example, we'll talk a little bit about the dabigatran study, and that was a classic example. And I bring it up only because it's the very most recent, is that when they added agents, you can look back and see, I think it was 90-95% were on an ACE, ARB, or sacubitril with valsartan, I think it is.
No, exactly.
And so they were on one of those, they were on beta blockers, and I think 70% were on spironolactone or plerinone or something like that, mineral corticoid. So they were, you know, these people, so when you're seeing these benefits, you're seeing them on top. As you know, one of the struggles we've had with statins in the past is many of the trials tried to look at patients not on statins, which and then do a placebo-controlled trial when statins really are the standard of care first.
Yeah, no.
So these ones are doing the right thing. They're adding it on.
Yeah, and one class of drugs that most people are on also on you know the Lasix or the furosemides and that sort of stuff as well. So, and we'll talk briefly about those as well. So and then to try to really get everyone's focus in a way to think about these medications, there's a fair amount of consistency with the endpoints that these clinical trials look at, and the two that we're going to talk about throughout the entire discussion is overall mortality and heart failure hospitalizations. There are other outcomes that have been measured, sometimes surrogate markers and so on, but those are really the consistent ones. And I think most people, think that overall mortality and heart failure hospitalizations are important.
They are important outcomes, and they're also indicators of so mortality is obviously not an indicator for anything because it is the final, but the hospitalizations is not only something that patients want to avoid, but it's also an indication of deteriorating status. So the more of those you have, the worse off you are, that kind of thing. So I think they're quite a reasonable assessment of patients who might be deteriorating in their condition.
Yeah. And then, you know, one of the questions I always have when I see people coming out of hospital is, you know, they're on many medications, and it always appears to me, obviously, that they've had a, you know, especially if it's their first onset of heart failure, secondary to, is usually ischemia, but not always, is, you know, do they actually feel any better? I mean, they're feeling terrible now, and we put them on drugs that basically make your blood pressure close to zero. And so quality of life is a really important issue associated with it. And unfortunately, these studies don't capture quality of life very well, sometimes if at all. And so that is tricky. We can talk about the endpoints of overall mortality and heart failure hospitalizations, but whether or not these people really feel better is tricky.
For sure. And yeah. And that, as you said, it's not captured. The best way to surrogate that is the heart failure hospitalizations, but that's an extreme stretch. Like
exactly.
It would be relatively easy to measure this, but we get wrapped up in those two outcomes, which is standard. Yeah.
And then the issue of harms are not, as with almost every clinical trial ever done in the history of the world, they're poorly captured.
Yeah. So as we're finding out now, we're doing a review of evidence for OA, and the harms are virtually never captured in that, despite the fact that we know there are some.
Yeah, so. No, exactly. Interesting. So the landscape that we're working on, at least here in Canada, I'm sure it's somewhat similar everywhere else, is we're working with 22, at least in Canada, like I said, Canada, 22 different medications, and they come from, there's the ACEs, there's the ARBs, there's the beta blockers, there's the mineralocorticoids, there's the ARNIs. For those of you who don't know that, that's the sacubitril and valsartan combination. There's the eye inhibitors, and it depends on how you say the drug, but it's a new one, ivabradine. And then you've got from the past, the vasodilators, hydralazine, furosemide, and then the diuretics and thiazides and so on. So those are that's the framework that we're working from. And so what we want to do is go over each of those, the evidence around all of those. And I think as we've done with hypertension and lipids and so on, I think it's a very useful thing to frame where we are when it comes to the overall, you know, what happens if we don't do anything? And there are some sort of models that have been put together. One's called the Seattle Heart Failure Model. It gives us an idea of what is the overall mortality if we don't do any treatment. And I thought, why don't we just run through those numbers and then talk about hospital admissions. And then that'll frame it to go, where do we go from there?
So yeah, and I think it's important that people know that we're talking here in this kind of classic, the classes of heart failure, kind of 1 to 4 that we often think about.
Yeah. So I just sort of ran a model through this Seattle Heart Failure Model to get some ballpark numbers. And so if you're a 65-year-old, and it doesn't really matter whether you're male or female, but if you've got class 1 heart failure, your mortality at 1 year is around 5% and goes up to about 33% at 5 years. So that's class 1. Starts at about 5 at 1 year and goes up to 33%. Now, as you know, Mike, almost all of the studies are done on class 2 to 3 heart failure. So I think that's sort of a number we can focus on is, in class 2 to 3 heart failure, at 1 year, mortality is 15%, which is fairly, that's an impressively high mortality.
Yeah, it's bad.
Yeah,
it's exactly. Bad, James. The word you're looking for is bad.
Yeah, you heard it here. Heart failure, bad.
Bad.
And then at 5 years, we're talking 50% mortality. So we start at 15% for 1 year and go up to 50%. And then class 4, which we'll talk about a little bit at the end when we talk about the mineralocorticoids and the spironolactone and so on. And they start off with a 25% one-year mortality, and it goes up to 80% at 5 years if you're class 4. So that's the framework that we're talking about. And I think the numbers you might want to just remember for now is 15% at 1 year and 50% at 5 years, 50% at 5 years for class 2 and 3. And yeah. then those numbers are pretty consistent what we see in the studies that are put out. And then the heart failure or hospitalization for heart failure, over the 2 to 3 years that we see the clinical trials being done, the chance of being hospitalized for heart failure is around 15 to 20%. So those are the numbers that we're working at. Mortality at 2 years is around 25%, and hospital admissions for heart failure are around 15 to 20%. So that's the framework that we need to work on and do the studies, do the medications, reduce that. So does that sort of make sense, I hope, Mike?
It sure does. And I think it matches with what we see in practice, right?
Yeah.
We know when our patients are headed downhill with this, and many people talk about the class 4 heart failure as, you know, moving into a palliative type position.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So we have a whole bunch of different things that we can do to treat heart failure. And, you know, we've already talked about the list of medications, but we've also got stuff to do with exercise and activity. We've got salt and so on. So why don't we'll just spend a little bit of time talking about sort of the non-drug treatments, because they are being used, and we need to put it into context. And so when it comes to sort of what we call exercise-based rehabilitation for heart failure, there have been a couple of reviews, in a journal called Open Heart in 2015, and very similar findings were seen in a recent Cochrane review. And again, we'll put links to all of this information in the show notes. So there have been about 33 trials that have looked at exercise-based rehabilitation and just over 4,700 subjects. And they evaluated a number of different types of activity, if you will. Sometimes it was resistance training. Sometimes it was aerobic. And it ranged from 15 to 120 minutes, 1 to 7 sessions a week. So it's all over the board. And we typically see that with most exercise trials is there's a consistent lack of consistency, if you will, right, Mike?
For sure. And it's driven by a whole bunch of things, because people wonder, you know, it's an element of curiosity, and maybe you have a certain belief system that a mix of weight training with aerobic exercise would benefit. And then the next person thinks that it's mostly aerobic exercise and so on. And then they want to prove that. And then that you think, well, your type of aerobic, which was a bicycle, is not as good as mine, which is doing aerobics in a swimming pool and blah, blah, blah. And, I mean, pretty soon you end up with this massive number of variants in different types of exercise, in which the confidence intervals grossly overlap each other. And we never know if anyone is actually better than the other.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're not going to be able to tell you specifically which one has an effect, but when they've looked at all of this stuff, compared with the controls, and again, these would not be placebo controlled trials, but they showed that after 1 year, all cause mortality, the risk ratio was 0.93. So that's about a 7% relative reduction. But the confidence intervals included one, so we can't rule out that there was no benefit at all. So that's about a 7% reduction. And then follow up at 1 year, just about statistically significant reduction in mortality. The risk ratio was 0.88, which means about a 12% reduction. And the confidence intervals were anywhere from 0.75 to 1.02. So, and I think if you just globally look at that, you could maybe suggest that mortality roughly might be reduced by about 10%. That would be the number I would go after.
It's either going to be slightly better or similar.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So then you can frame that into the context of, well, how big a benefit would you get from doing that? If you you know, look back at the previous numbers that we were talking about, if the 1 year mortality was about 15% in class 2 to 3, if you take 10% off of that, that's about a 1.5% reduction, because 1.5 mm-hmm. is 10% of 15. So your risk of mortality would go from 15% down to about 13.5%. Now,
wait a minute, James. Next week is this week heart failure, and next week is algebra? I can't remember what we're planning to do for podcasts. Well,
this is actually
grade, calculus.
No, it's grade 5 math we're talking about. So, but we realize these can be tricky, and it's not because people don't know the numbers, but or know how to do it. It's just often, at least maybe you can tell me. I know when I present this stuff, especially sometimes to residents and clinicians, I sometimes have to go over this grade 5 math because they have not done grade 5 math in their head for years. And so that's why I'm not trying to.
I get you. It's funny. Like many people really, it's almost like it becomes a gray haze as soon as we start talking about percents of percents.
Yeah. No, exactly. And then, so that was the mortality benefit. And then they also looked at heart failure specific hospitalizations, and the risk ratio was 0.61, and the confidence intervals around it were 0.46 to 0.8. So clearly a statistical difference. And so if you want to go ballpark, about a 40% reduction in heart failure specific hospitalizations, which is relatively impressive if it's a consistent effect. So if we go back to what we talked about before, if the chance of hospital admission for heart failure over 2 to 3 years is about 20%, and we can knock 40% off of that, that's not too bad at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's pretty good.
Yeah. So go ahead, Mike. You want to say something?
Well, one of the things with any exercise is we know that it generally improves quality of life.
Yes.
More than the others where you've kind of scratched your head because of the mixed bag that drugs bring. Mm-hmm. But with exercise, we know that over time in other studies, whether it be depression, just people without depression, et cetera, they feel better when they're when they've been exercising.
Yeah, no, exactly.
So what's the story there, James?
Well, yeah. So again, we talked about earlier about the studies don't really look at quality of life all that effectively. So some of these exercise-based studies did look at sort of something called the Minnesota Living with Heart Failure Questionnaire, which is sort of a clinically sort of quality of life sort of stuff. And they were able to show an improvement in this of about 6 points on a 100-point scale.
Now, but you have to live in Minnesota.
Yeah, which really is not good quality of life. Because I've been there once. It was so cold. But that was many years ago. Maybe they've got a dome now that they all live under. But so at least there was a little bit of evidence. I mean, clearly it's not taking everyone and making them feel absolutely terrific. But at least there was some suggestion of a benefit. And like you said, at least in my opinion, if they're going to do this sort of activity, I hope they enjoy it. Because if they don't enjoy it, then, you know, is there really a benefit from a quality of life perspective? So I'm sure that with these sorts of things, we can get people doing things that they enjoy. And what type of activity they should be doing, your guess is as good as mine. So why don't you tell them exactly what they should do, Mike, because you know.
First of all, I did want to comment that the statement that Minnesota was cold came from a Canadian.
a Canadian that lives in Vancouver, which is quite different than the rest of the world or rest of Canada.
Yeah. And then the next thing is that, you know, there's elements to even if you don't absolutely love what you're doing when you're exercising, mm-hmm. there is likely the benefits are almost post hoc, there afterwards, because you feel a sense of feeling good about yourself because you've done things. So I know you've always said, James, that they should be something you love, but there's also a bit of a mixed picture there. You might not always love it while you're doing it.
Yeah, you don't have to love it, but you shouldn't hate it is all I'm saying.
Okay. All right. Let's go on to the next thing, which is diet. And I know you enter with a package. We all do when it comes to diet, a package of biases.
Yeah, yeah.
What the results are going to be, but this is a mixed bag anyhow.
Oh yeah. And so at least for years and years, we were always taught that in heart failure patients, you should reduce salt intake. I mean, that was really pretty much the first thing you were supposed to say for everyone. I'm sure when you were going to school, that was the case, wasn't it, Mike?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, salt is heavily advocated against when it comes to
your heart,
blood pressure, just about anything to do with your heart, but certainly blood pressure and heart failure.
Yeah, so this has been looked at, and I'll be honest with you, the data is crappy. There is just not a lot of good information. There's been about, and this is from a review in 2018 from JAMA Internal Medicine, 9 trials, a total of 479 subjects. So that tells you not a lot of people in each one of these trials. And their bottom line was, if you're looking at outcomes like cardiovascular associated mortality, all-cause mortality, strokes, and MIs, and they're just insufficient data to make any commentary about whether it benefits or not. And then they also reported on 2 studies that showed that if you did reduced salt intake, that New York Heart Association functional class was improved, and then 2 that said it wasn't improved. So it is, right now, I don't think we have any good evidence one way or the other to support reducing salt intake or not.
I know you've put here that there are 9 trials. I suspect with 9 trials, there are 10 answers.
Yeah, no, exactly. So if you're really looking for an evidence-based statement from us about this, I don't think you're going to get it. So, I mean, when you see that, what do you do with patients with heart failure? Do you talk about the salt in any way or sodium?
Sometimes I do, but not very often, actually. I have to confess that it isn't an area that I focus on. And I remember Mike Culver was saying when he was talking about this, like telling a and he's Ukrainian, so he raised this, telling a Ukrainian not to eat pickles and sausages and those kind of things is basically significantly eroding their quality of life.
No,
so
exactly.
And there I had a wonderful heart failure patient who and she was Ukrainian through and through, and exactly what Mike said. So I wasn't sure how much time she had left, and we focused on other things because her family kept telling on her that she was still eating some of these things, but it's because she loved them and she didn't know how much time she had left.
Yeah, no, exactly. So that's pretty much all the information that we have on non-drug treatments, at least that I could find. So why don't we quickly run through, we'll just start to do just a little bit of stuff with some of the medications, and then we'll put a halt to the podcast. How does that sound, Mike?
Sounds perfect. Let's talk about diuretics are kind of the classic mainstay of treatment, James. So what do they, other than making people feel, I think this is one of these ones that, I mean, we can study this, but if you have someone in acute heart failure or worsening chronic heart failure and you don't bump up their, and I'm going to use the trade name Lasix because that's what everyone will know. If you don't bump up their Lasix, you know the path they're on, the direction they're headed.
No, exactly.
And you know what makes them feel better. So it's one of these things that it's almost, it's kind of one of those all or nothing effects. It's so dramatic. How many randomized control trials do you really need? So what we're looking at here is, does it help with the more... I don't think you need quality of life data for this one. What we need is mortality and heart failure admissions, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And so now we get into the trouble of, these are much older trials, and almost all of these were trials that were done before we had other treatments, especially before beta blockers were used, and many of them were before even ACE inhibitors came out. And there are not a lot of really well-designed randomized controlled trials. And in fact, some of the data, and this is out of a Cochrane review from a number of years ago, that some of the trials were not randomized controlled trials of placebo, but they were actually withdrawal trials. So they took people, because everybody had people on diuretics, they just withdrew them, and then they noticed that they got worse. So it's a bit of a gamish, if you will, of evidence. But when you look at it, if you look at the effect on mortality and heart failure worsening, which is sort of what we've been focusing on, if you look at mortality over the 2 to 12 month period, we're looking at a mortality on placebo of 12%. And with diuretics, primarily the loop diuretics like furosemide, it goes down to 3%. So that's an impressive reduction in mortality over, let's even say in the worst case scenario,
a very short time.
Yeah, like a year. And then heart failure worsening was 15% in placebo, and in the diuretic, it was 0. So, you know, you don't do statistics necessarily on that. It's relatively clear.
Yeah, you don't need to. But There is some caveats to this data, and you've already mentioned a number of them, like primarily loops. There were thiazide diuretics linked in here, and we know that thiazides don't generally have much diuresis with them. So it would, I mean, to me, the question is still out there. Would thiazides or thiazide-like diuretics like chlorothalidone or indapamide, would they help with heart failure? I don't know. I truly don't know.
No. But and right. I don't think anyone knows, but boy, a lot of people have opinions, you know, because they'll talk about, you know, the you've got to get past this renal threshold, or, you know, you increase the dose, or you use combinations of, you know, there are some studies that don't look at the sort of hard endpoints that look at, you know, if you add a thiazide to a loop diuretic, can you overcome some of the resistance? And I'm using resistance in big air quotes, the resistance to the loop diuretics. And there's some evidence, but it's just difficult evidence to even look through. So I think what, and this was from the European Cardiology Journal in 2015, I think the only certainty, this is a quote, the only certainty is that these therapies can relieve the patient's symptoms and reduce vascular congestion. And Mike, as you mentioned, you can see it within sometimes minutes of giving IV furosemide.
Oh yeah, it is it as far as the acute management of deteriorating heart failure, it is a remarkable drug. I've seen it given in heart failure so much so that we ended up having to rehydrate people, like, because we overdid it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So, you know, as with any good thing, you can just way overdo it. And it's, you know, you do want to, you know, get rid of some of that volume, but you need volume to live. So, you know, you can only get rid of
it. Out.
Yeah. So it turns out that, you know, you heard it here first. You need,
water.
Yeah. Right. But so we definitely know these have an effect. And then, you know, people might ask, well, what's the best loop diuretic? I have no idea. There's a whole bunch of them. Tarasamide, bumetanide. I don't know if they're any better than furosemide. And I certainly know reviews have not helped us out.
I know that when their renal failure gets bad, we'll often switch to metalazone.
Yeah.
But as one nephrologist told me, that drug will get water from a stone.
Yeah. So, you know,
that's the last stage.
Yeah. And if you'd have started with that one, you'd have probably gone, well, if that doesn't work, we'd go to furosemide.
Furosemide. You know. Absolutely.
And then, you know, when we look at the, you know, the thiazide-like diuretics, we've already talked a bit about that, you know, when we've talked about for diuretic resistance. I don't know. These guys came up with the conclusion there's no clear evidence that any single thiazide-like diuretic is superior to another. And, you know, how effective they are in general is not really well known. So that's pretty much what we have. But I think the key message here is that these, I'm going to go on a bit of a limb here, I think these are the only drugs that you can really titrate to effect. I don't think the rest of them we can, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but these definitely can.
Oh, yeah, and they're highly. So, like, this is the one where you're having your heart failure patients measure their weight at home, because you're going to fuss primarily with their furosemide, because that's the thing you know is going to – and so I find it a very – it's such a responsive tool, more than almost any drug we have in our armamentarium to really affect – positively, quality of life, risk of admission, all of those kind of things.
Yeah, so you can actually use your clinical skills to deal with this drug versus just, and we'll talk about the rest of them in a minute. So we'll just quickly touch on digoxin and the nitrates, and then we'll leave the mainstay medications for the next podcast. How's that sound?
Sounds perfect.
Okay, good. So again, for those of you who've been around for many years, one of the mainstays of treatment of heart failure was digoxin. And up until just very close to the year 2000, we didn't actually have great evidence that digoxin, or we didn't know what digoxin did. And there was a trial that was published in 1997 in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it was the DIG trial. And they looked at 3,800 patients over 3 years, people who had a New York Heart Association 2 to 3. And so this is a very typical trial that looked at these medications. And what they did is they looked at a number of things, but the two outcomes that were most important were the heart failure hospitalizations and mortality. So the heart failure hospitalizations on placebo were around 35% and went down to about 27%. So that's about an 8% absolute reduction in heart failure hospitalizations, which again, Mike, I think you would agree that would be a clinically important effect if you could do it without side effects.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So that was a good thing. Now, what didn't happen was that mortality didn't change. It was 35% pretty much in both arms. And so because of that lack of effect on mortality, digoxin based on that study did fall out of favor, if you remember, when it came out.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. This was and in fact, we don't see it really encouraged much.
No.
Because it's got lots of other caveats that aren't captured by the data we've just gone through, which mm-hmm. is that it can be quite toxic. It's very susceptible to dosing. And so you have to be much more careful with. This is unfortunate for me personally, because I grow not by intention, but all sorts of foxglove all over the property that
right.
I own.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
I could potentially make a killing if this
Yeah, and, like, and the word killing is appropriate.
it was unintentional.
I know.
I see you didn't let that slip. Yeah.
I would never let that, because you know that's my job.
Right. Okay. Let's talk about nitrates.
Yeah. So we have, and we don't see these much used anymore. I mean, we do see nitrates obviously for chest pain and stuff like that, sort of in a similar way to what we see with furosemide. I don't mean for chest pain, but we use it for symptoms. But there's not a lot of data on this. But again, this has been studied in, and there was an article that a study that came out in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2004. Where they looked at the combination of isosorbide dinitrate and hydralazine and compared that to placebo in just over 1,000 black patients who were in New York Heart Association Category 3, and looked at them for just under a year, about 10 months. And in this trial, they were able to show about a similar reduction in heart failure hospitalizations as we saw with the DIGE trial. Again, this was only over 1 year because these people had worse heart failure, but it went from about 25% down to about 16%. So that's sort of an 8 or 9% absolute benefit. And in this case, mortality was also reduced by about 4%. So that was encouraging in this, at least this one trial. But what they found was, and people who've ever used nitrates and drugs like hydralazine, you do find a lot of side effects. So the number of people who complained of dizziness and headache were in the neighborhood of an absolute increase, somewhere in the sort of 15 to sometimes as high as 30%. So because of that, even though there has been a benefit shown in this single trial, I think they've fallen into... we don't use them nearly as much because of the consistent side effects that you see with these medications. And as you know, as well as I do, that pretty much everyone who you give nitrates to will say something about a headache.
Yeah, it's very common. And it's unfortunate because the drugs do work. How well do they work in the sea of
everything
medications
else, yeah,
that we have now? We're not sure, but it's probably... as you said, what's probably holding this intervention back is the adverse event profile more than anything.
And they're not on patent, or they went off patent many, many years ago. Right.
And that is a big deal, because it drives the marketing for that. And that marketing, no matter how much we want to talk negatively about it, it does affect our practice. And sometimes not necessarily in a bad way.
Yeah.
So reminding us about the benefits of products that have been proven in large clinical trials, sometimes we need that.
Yeah, no, exactly. So I think we'll leave it at that, Mike. We've sort of touched on some of the evidence for activity, which is pretty good. We've looked mm-hmm. at the salt stuff, not all that good. We've talked about a couple of classes of medications, and then we'll talk about in the next podcast some of the more mainstays, one that virtually every person seems to be on when they get heart failure. So the PIPE conference just finished, and I was there, and I heard it was a great success despite that.
Despite your presence.
Yeah, exactly. And as we've mentioned in many of the other podcasts, there's a course coming up the third week, I think April 24, 25, or 25, 26 next year in Vancouver, where all the usual suspects will be at. And so please continue to listen to all the other podcasts. Check out all the tools for practice that we put out on a regular basis. We're working very hard on another guideline for osteoarthritis. Yeah, go ahead.
Just for pain. It'll be three stages, osteoarthritis pain, then followed by back pain, then neuropathy pain, just the most common chronic pain conditions seen in primary care. And then we'll have a guideline. But at each stage, we'll have a systematic review and a kind of knowledge translation tool for you.
Yeah. So I think we'll leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.